This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Welcome and thanks for joining us today. I'm Joel Hilliker. Understanding biblical prophecy is an invaluable guide to processing what is happening in the world today. In our first segment on today's program, we'll resume the series we've been doing on how to understand the news, and we're going to focus on the key to understanding events in Asia, and then we'll look at four overall trends in the world that you should be watching for. In our second segment, we're going to continue with a theme I talked about last Wednesday, socialism. We'll have a conversation with a man who has a very interesting perspective on the way that governments and peoples are responding to coronavirus. He spent quite a bit of time in communist countries, and he sees the way that people are turning more and more power over to their governments and giving up freedoms and expecting handouts and relief from their governments as steps towards socialism and even communism. His name is Peter DeLau. And we'll talk to him from his current home in England. I think you'll find it a very intriguing conversation. Then we'll switch gears and talk about sunshine. COVID-19 has everyone staying indoors, but too much of that deprives you of the enormous health benefits of sunlight. We'll talk to holistic nutritionist and personal trainer Jorg Mardian about why it's important to get a good daily dose of vitamin D from the rays of the sun. And I'll finish off the program by giving you a key ingredient in how to become a doer of the word. Let's start, though, with some very helpful keys to watching and understanding current events. As you watch your world, how can you make sure you focus on what is most important? Biblical prophecy is your guide. When you keep the prophecies of the Bible in view, then you can see the hand of God in world events in some very exciting ways. And you get a real sense of how events are leading to the greatest event in history, the second coming of Jesus Christ. We've been studying the key that we receive from prophetic understanding, and that key is knowing the modern identities of the peoples and nations spoken of in the Bible's end time prophecies. We've looked at Britain and America, we've looked at Germany and Europe, and also Iran and the Middle East. Now let's look at the overview the Bible gives us of Asia in end time events. In the last installment, we studied the pivotal prophecy of Daniel 11. This identifies the King of the North and the King of the South. These are two geopolitical powers that will clash spectacularly in the end time. These we can recognize as a German-led European empire and an Iran-led Islamic alliance. That same passage in Daniel 11 also discusses another group of nations that are prophesied to play a major role in end-time prophetic events. This bloc will be located to the east and the north of the location where that above-mentioned clash takes place. Verse 44 in Daniel 11 says, "But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble this revived European empire." Now, if you look at the Middle East on a map, it's clear that to the north and east are Russia, China, and their neighboring nations. Revelation 16 and verse 12 calls this end-time confederacy of Asian countries the kings of the east. Revelation 9:16 says that this bloc will field a combined army of a jaw-dropping 200 million soldiers. The jaw drops even further when you contemplate how many people were alive when that prophecy was written. Population estimates by historian John Tanton show that only a little more than a total of 150 million people were on earth around AD 90 when the Apostle John recorded this prophecy. That is compelling evidence that this prophecy didn't come from a human being. It came from the mind of an almighty God who can foretell the future, and that this prophecy is for the modern age. After all, it's only been in very recent times that populations have grown large enough to make a military force of that size even possible. Even in this age of population explosion, where could an army that massive come from? Historical data shows that nations can field an army of about one fighting man for every 15 adults in the population. In extremes, one in 10 adults could be made soldiers. In the United States today, there are about 250 million adults. That means in times of extreme duress, America could possibly field an army of 25 million troops. That's more than 15 times the current number. By this formula, the European Union's vast population could field a force of around 40 million. The combined countries of Latin America could produce an army of 48 million. Those in Africa, 70 million. These are impressive figures, but they're still far below the 200 million man force that Revelation 9 verse 16 prophesies will rise up in the end time. It is only from a combination of Asian nations that a force of this staggering size could be assembled. Now, depending on which Eastern countries you include, it's not difficult to reach combined populations of 2.5 billion to 4 billion people. So even if you go with the low end of this estimate, building a military of 200 million men is demographically realistic. Shortly after the Great Flood, a prophecy was made about the man from whom the Asian peoples descended. Genesis 9 and verse 27 says, "God shall enlarge Japheth." When we look at the vast populations of the Asian nations today, it's easy to see that this enlargement has come to pass. And it's also easy to see why the European King of the North power in Daniel 11 will be, quote, troubled by the actions or the threats of this gargantuan and mighty Asiatic military force. You can read more details about this Asian army in passages like Jeremiah 50 and Joel 2, but there's a lot in Ezekiel chapter 38 that gives key details about this Asian power block. Verse 8 shows that this chapter, Ezekiel 38, is about the latter years. And that phrase describes the time we're living in right now. If you want to prove this, you can study our article, "Are These the Last Days?" We'll link to that in our show notes for this program. This chapter of Ezekiel is about the times we now live in and the years in the immediate future. And it includes some astounding details about who will lead the 200 million man army of the kings of the East during these tumultuous times. Verses 1 and 2 say, "And the word of the Eternal came to me, saying, Son of man, set your face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him." Now, who is this prince mentioned here? The details of this passage paint a clear picture. Bible scholars generally agree that Gog refers to Russia, and the land of Magog includes the vast area where modern-day China is located. Meshech is a group of people whose name appears throughout history in several variations: Musku, Muski, Mushki. These are all related to the modern Russian spelling of Moscow. Tubal refers to another section of Russia. To the east of Russia's Ural Mountains lies the city of Tobolsk, which is named after the Tobol River, a name derived from the ancient name Tubal. Tobolsk was formerly the headquarters of the Russian government over the Siberian expanse, and it functioned essentially as the capital of Russia's Asian region. And yet another name for all of Russia lies somewhat hidden in this passage. There's disagreement over how the Hebrew word Rosh should be translated into English in this verse. The King James Version renders it as the adjective chief, but the correct translation used by the Moffat, the American Standard Version, Young's Literal Translation, and others renders it not as an adjective, but as a proper noun, Rosh. So properly translated, this verse reads, "The prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal." Now Rosh was an ancient name for Russia, once called Rus. Many histories and commentaries, including Gill's exposition of the entire Bible, acknowledge this. So the identity of this prince of Russia, Moscow, and Tobolsk begins to take clear shape. The list of all three names confirms that this is one individual ruling over all the various peoples across Russia, from Kaliningrad in the west to Vladivostok in the east. And the mention of Magog shows that this man's leadership extends beyond the borders of Russia and into China. Verses 5 and 6 show that the peoples of such nations as India, Japan, the Koreas, Cambodia, Thailand, Myanmar, Laos, and Vietnam will also come under Russia's influence and lend their military might and their soldiers to this Moscow-led bloc. If you want to learn more about this, order a free copy of our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, wrote a booklet called The Prophesied Prince of Russia about this specific subject. And that booklet says this: this world has a lot of authoritarian rulers, but Vladimir Putin is one we need to keep a particularly close eye on. His track record, his nationality, and his ideology show that he is fulfilling a linchpin Bible prophecy. The time frame of his rule also shows that nobody else could be fulfilling the Ezekiel 38 and 39 prophecy. Now, this booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, is also freely available. We'd love to give you a copy of that. Mr. Flory also explains that since Vladimir Putin plays a personal role in end-time prophecy, the fact that he's on the scene today shows just how near the return of the Messiah is. These prophecies are a crucial key to understanding events in Asia today. I highly encourage you to prove these prophetic identities and the specific prophecies the Bible gives us to watch for regarding this continent. You can visit our trends page at thetrumpet.com, and you can find articles like Why the Trumpet Watches a Russian Strongman Dominating Asia, Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China, Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Toward Militarism, and Why the Trumpet Watches China's Rise as a Superpower. So we've come to understand how the major nations in the world today are identified in the Bible's prophecies, including Britain and America, Germany, Iran. Now we've seen Russia and China and other nations associated with each of these main power blocks. So we've identified four primary power blocks that are driving world events in the period leading up to Jesus Christ's return: Anglo-America, Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. Now, prophecy also tells us the general trend and the interactions to watch for in each of these four groups. The Bible tells us to watch in the end time for America and Britain to be declining in power, for the King of the South and the King of the North to be rising in power, and the kings of the East to be coming together. Now, are we seeing these trends happening on the world scene today? Yes, we absolutely are. The modern world provides eye-popping evidence proving the dependability of God's word and God's prophecies. The Bible also gives us an outline of the major interactions these blocks will have with one another. And some of them we can already see in the early stages of fulfillment. First, all of them will work against America to bring it down. Then, with the world's major superpower crippled, the King of the South will push at the King of the North and subsequently be destroyed by it. You can see that in Daniel 11, verses 40 through 43. The King of the North will next push at the kings of the East, who will counterattack. That's described in Revelation 16, verses 12 through 14. So that is the overall picture given in the Bible. So when you're looking at world events, what do you watch for? Well, the nearer to this formula, whatever you're watching is, the more important it is. We have to be able to see world events as they are leading to the fulfillment of these prophecies. How is a specific event bringing America and Britain down, or exalting the King of the South, or helping the King of the North, or bringing the kings of the East into closer cooperation? That is the approach that the Philadelphia Trumpet takes. These are the questions we ask to determine an event's newsworthiness. If the Trumpet doesn't extensively cover an event that some people may think as very major, it's really because it's not relevant within this prophetic framework. Now, of course, we shouldn't get too simplistic. Often things transpire in a way we might not expect. And as the Apostle Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 12, at present we only see as through a glass darkly. We shouldn't assume that we clearly see every detail of the entire picture. But being mindful of this overview often helps us to see the reality behind what is occurring and to see where it's truly leading. This is what gives the trumpet its unique perspective and understanding that even the world's most brilliant news analysts lack. In Matthew 13, verses 16 and 17, Jesus Christ explained this truth to his disciples. But blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For verily I say unto you that many prophets and righteous men have desired to see those things which you see and have not seen them, and to hear those things which you hear and have not heard them. This is an extraordinary truth, and it shows that even the brightest minds are not able to see the true significance of world events because they're not watching them through the lens of Bible prophecy. In addition to this overall picture, God gives us several specifics to watch for in each of these areas. We already spoke in an earlier episode about those prophecies regarding Britain and America, prophecies about economic crash, decline in health, pestilence and disease epidemics, famines, weather and climactic disasters, violence within our cities, terrorist attacks, and far worse to come. Concerning the King of the South, the Bible prophesies of the rise of Iran and radical Islam and their domination of the Middle East, their influence over Iraq, some level of partnership with Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia, increasing military might, support of terrorist attacks against America and British nations, backing of the Palestinians against the Jews, conquest of East Jerusalem, provocation of Europe, and obliteration by a European force, and initiation of World War III. Prophecies relating to the King of the North include those foretelling German political and economic domination of Europe and its rise to global dominance, return to fascism, increase in racist crime, the popularity of neo-Nazism, a political swing to the right, economic and social destabilization, institution of a federal system of law and order, establishment of a police state, alliance with the Vatican, development of a European army, colonization within the Mediterranean, Northern Africa, ex-Soviet satellite countries, and the Balkans, the rise of a demagogue who obtains office by flatteries, the adoption of the role of aggressive peacemaker on the world scene, temporary cooperation with Russia, role as chief negotiator for peace in the Middle East, temporary alliance between Germany and China and Japan, continued internal division, destruction of the Islamic nations, and conquest of Jerusalem, America, and Britain. In Asia, or the kings of the East, biblical prophecy specifies the emergence of one massive power bloc, the departure of America's presence, the improvement of relations among countries in the region, greater collusion between Russia, China, India, and Japan, the rallying of Russian satellites to the mother country, complete self-reliance economically and militarily, a massive military buildup, the formation of the most gargantuan army in history, and the annihilation of the European power and the march to Armageddon. Just think about that list and realize how many of these events are already in motion. We can watch them happening in our daily news, just as God said.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Many nations are going into deep debt to mitigate the economic fallout of the coronavirus lockdowns. A lot of people are receiving relief checks. Here in the United States, millions are suddenly drawing unemployment checks. In the short term, all this social protection and welfare is nice to have, but there are long-term costs. In fact, the steps that build a welfare state lead to socialism, even communism. We're going to talk now to a man who has a fair bit of experience firsthand with communism. He's lived in Hungary. He spent considerable time in East Germany and Poland. He's visited communist Czechoslovakia. His name is Peter DeLau. We have him via Skype from his home in England. Hello, Peter.
Hello there. Hi.
It's good to be talking with you. Before we get into some of your experiences in communist countries, I just wanted to talk about why this is important. This has been on your mind as you've been watching governments expand these welfare offerings. And as you see it, this is moving inevitably toward socialist economic model. Can you just talk about what you see from your perspective?
Yes, and why it is important, because I started from seeing the results of it, because I did see dictatorships, and I did see even people being shot, or I heard it at least, and so I saw torture rooms. So I started thinking about that more. How can a state evolve, let's call it that way, into something so evil? And actually it all starts with people wanting to be dependent from the government, because it's easy. Mm-hmm. And the government, they start off very friendly and very democratically. They organize elections, and to win elections, you have to give them something like candy. You have to give them money, or give them something for free. Each time the government gives something, the government gets bigger, because then the government needs like a department to administer everything they hand out and to make sure that the rules are adhered to. Each time you have a department or an administration that has to take care of all that and look after it, then those people have a fixed job. You cannot fire them anymore. They want to stay in positions where they are. It's also easy for people who are in power to position their own friends in such departments. So that's another reason not to abolish them. But with the next election, there's another promise and another regulation and another handout and so on and so on, until it gets very bloated. Mm-hmm. It's like a self-supporting system, and the people love it because if you take away something from them, it's like an addiction. It's like a heroin addiction that you cannot take away anymore, or it's going to be revolt, or they lose the elections big time.
So how much, as you're hearing, say, the way that, looking at it from an American perspective, and I don't know how much you're following what's happening here specifically, we're seeing the same kind of pattern play out in a lot of nations, but in America, it seems like there are a lot of government officials who are actually looking for ways to get people more dependent, where it is the way that you're describing it, it's the ulterior motive behind offering those types of things. How much do you see that as directly, this is the direct result that they're trying to achieve, where they're gaining that power to themselves? There's nothing, even though the language is altruistic, it is very selfish and it is very power hungry.
It is. And even if they don't start like that, it seems to be an addiction after a while, and you get into power and then you cannot relinquish power anymore. And now at least you see it a lot also in America. I couldn't believe it that it would happen in America when I was younger. I lived through the Reagan years, and yeah, when America was at the summit of its power and freedom and ideals, and now I see this. And actually, I understand it from a human point of view, human nature. People want power. It gives them, power and money are the big drives, I mean, behind human actions. And in a sense, it's hard to give it away. At least you have to give it away then, the power, or relinquish the power to your enemy, in this case Mr. Trump, or whoever the enemy is, because you hate the person and you want to keep your own position for yourself, so you do everything within your means to keep that. And it starts with a small lie and another lie that you tell yourself in the end, and you start believing your lies. And also, when I was in Belgium, I also joined politics idealistically. I wanted to change my country, but after a while I just had to quit. As I saw this behavior already 15 years ago or more, and I took with politics, I couldn't do it. So before I was in the church, because of that reason, it was all about the own party and about the self, and the party is the God. That's what you have to worship.
Well, let's talk about some of the specifics. As you're seeing, even in the United States right now, there's a lot of enthusiasm for socialism. Given your experiences, you've already intimated about some of them. What are some of the problems that come from living in a socialist or a communist state?
The problem is, well, as I said, it starts off like with an ideal, and you want to, for instance, guarantee full employment, because it's always a bit of a war between the classes. And so they want to appease the people and guarantee full employment, which they are doing now with those handouts, and also here in the UK. With those furloughs, people don't want to go back to work anymore. Even if they're allowed now, they don't want to. More than half do not want to go back to work because they still earn 80% of their salary for doing nothing. And that is the problem, because you have to keep on feeding this system, or there's going to be a revolt or a revolution. So you have to keep on feeding it. You have to, nothing is created anymore or manufactured, because you have your salary anyway, which means the government cannot admit things are going wrong, so they have to keep up appearances with lies, and whoever stands up against it, they have to suppress. Otherwise, the system just tumbles and just crumbles. And in a sense, that's how it starts. And there's always people who are more evil than others, and they take advantage of it. There's also a lot of police agents and executioners, even who like to torture, who are sadistic, and they get big chances in those systems. And I saw them with my own eyes. I did see, I did hear people being shot. I did see torture rooms. And that's where it eventually leads to. I did see people, a system where people have to snitch on each other or rat each other out, and nobody could trust anybody anymore. And it's just like a living hell. But this is ultimately the result, because you cannot escape it anymore unless you give up your own power and your own existence.
Can you get into some more specifics? You've lived and visited several countries, both before the Iron Curtain came down and after. Maybe we could just start by talking about the experience that you had as a young man in communist Czechoslovakia behind the Iron Curtain.
Yeah, that was very depressive. One of the most depressive trips or ever undertaken, and things I've ever seen in my life. It's like day and night. It's like light and darkness, and you come into darkness. There's no light in those. Even if the sun is shining, everything is gray. People are gray. They look gray. They're not happy. They're not friendly, because why would they? They have their salary. They have their misery lives. They're oftentimes drunk. All the buildings are gray. They're not painted, because why would you paint a building? It costs money, and there is no money in such communist systems, because that nothing is manufactured or produced. There is no wealth being created. So it's very depressing, and that's what you don't see a smile on the street. You don't see a smile when you enter a restaurant or a bar. Mm-hmm. The weird thing is, later on, just when the wall came down, I went to Eastern Germany and saw some friends there from a friend of mine, and they were actually looking back to the good times in communist times, because they said at least the government was looking after you.
Right.
Which is like revisionist history, of course, but it's not good. It's just very depressing.
So I guess that speaks to the point about just how addicted a person can become to receiving that kind of, those kind of benefits from the government.
Yeah. Yes. And they're not being trained or educated in taking responsibility for their own lives or their own actions. So it's all very easy, actually, the life, because whatever you do, you're being fed, even if the food is always the same, because when I was there for 1 week, we ate the same thing for an entire week, because this was the food for the week in that country. But still, it's an easy life. And if you're brought up like that, you can very easily get complacent and just go along with it.
You saw the residual effects from the communist government. You just mentioned having visited East Germany after the wall came down. You also spent time in Poland. And was it Hungary after the wall came down?
Yes.
So maybe you could just describe how much you saw even having lived under those conditions for quite a while, that the effects lingered.
Yes, many were struggling, because it was very abrupt. It was from one day of darkness, and the next day the wall came down, and you're in a totally different world, because the administrations or the governments or presidents, whatever you want to call them, they just were not in position anymore. And they were in a free capitalist market, so they had to struggle, because they had no notion of economics, even basic household economics. How do you spend a budget? Because they didn't know that. It was a big struggle. They didn't know how to make themselves employable, how to look for a job, how to create something that just didn't exist. And a lot of young people, they were very much struggling. That's why you still see in Eastern Germany, and so you see them going to the fringe parties, mostly the extreme right, but initially it was even the Communist Party again that was winning elections in Germany, because of those people clinging to what they knew, and they were not able to take responsibility of their own lives anymore.
Mm-hmm. There's something very attractive about the way that the socialist ideals are packaged, and the kind of language that a lot of the people who advocate these positions use, because it sounds like you're taking care of everybody and you want to make sure that nobody is left behind, nobody falls through the cracks. What you're describing is the reality of the situation. What do you think when you hear politicians making these kinds of promises, as we hear?
They are sounding nice, and I hear words like equality and inclusiveness, which are beautiful words in themselves, but actually what they mean is equality. Everybody is the same. There's no way they don't promote people educating themselves or excelling in a craft or a skill. Everybody has to be at the same level, more or less. The same with inclusiveness. There is everybody's dealt with in the same way, which means there's no motivation for people to excel or to educate themselves to become an expert or a genius in some kind of field. So in the end, it's a very oppressive term. Like in a capitalist system, once you fail, you can learn a lesson from it, and you can start anew, and you can then excel into something bigger and greater. In communist systems, that does not exist. You just first of all, you cannot fail, so to speak, because yeah, they pay you anyway for doing nothing. And secondly, there's no incentive to become something great or a great person.
So the way you would view it is that it's much more inhumane to put someone under that kind of a system, whereas the argument that they would make is that it's inhumane to have a system where you allow people to fail, and that when we have members of society who are not succeeding, that shows that there's some inherent flaw in the system. You put it back on the responsibility of the individual to take care of their own welfare.
Yes, right. And even if you can also have schools that are sponsored by a state or whatever a little bit, but I mean, but then they have to teach the right things, teach people how to get out of poverty, how to educate yourself, how to become homo universalis and a great person. That is what you have to teach people, and not how to comply with the party guidelines, so to speak, because they always use the word democratic. Republic of North Korea, Democratic Republic of Germany. And what they mean is democratic, we represent the entire population. There's one party who represents everybody, which is actually dictatorship. That's what it means. It's oppression. But they define all those words in their own advantage, and to take advantage of it.
The way that you're describing life in the socialist and the communist states, where everything is a shade of gray, it really is a stark contrast with the kind of vibrancy that you have in a country with free markets. I think Churchill said the inherent vice of capitalism is the unequal sharing of blessings. The inherent virtue of socialism is the equal sharing of miseries. It seems like when you look at even the poorer people in a free market system, they're better off than the ones who are the general standard of living underneath a communist state.
Yes, that is true. And especially as communist systems progress, in the very beginning, they can still benefit from the wealth they inherited from the capitalist system before them. But after some decades or generations, there is nothing left anymore and no wealth is being produced. So in a capitalist system, there is some poverty, or I could say inequality, yes, for sure, but it can be an incentive to look at people who are more successful and learn from them. And that's a possibility you have in a capitalist system. Whereas in a communist system, yeah, everybody's equal, but equally in deep, deep unhappy misery.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. We've been talking with Peter DeLau about the dangers of socialist thinking and the problems associated with life under communism. Peter, I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, you're welcome.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
If you had to name one of the greatest natural medicines that we know of, what would it be? Well, here's a hint. It's free, it's readily available, and research tells us it may be as important to our health as food and exercise. I'm talking about the sun. The vitamin D that we receive from the sun's rays is proven to prevent a number of common and often fatal diseases. So why then do experts malign sunshine as a carcinogen that we should avoid? To talk about this, we have via Skype from his office in British Columbia, holistic nutritionist and personal trainer Jorg Mardian. Hello, Jorg.
Hello.
We've got kind of a dreary day here in Oklahoma, so it's nice to be talking about sunshine. Tell us the benefits of sunlight.
Well, this was a fascinating research into sunlight because we really have to balance the immense benefits that we hear about against the supposed grave risks of skin cancer that experts tell us about every day. You know, so what is the balance between the two? So basically, it focuses on the ultraviolet rays that from the sun, and these are supposed to cause the skin cancer melanoma. And you know, but the very same exposure of those UV rays causes the vitamin D synthesis that you just talked about, that we need to keep our bones strong and protect against heart disease and osteoporosis and depression and many, many, many more benefits. Now, I looked at the British Medical Journal, and it tells us that vitamin D is actually protective against respiratory tract infections as well, like influenza and, guess what else, COVID-19. So in New York, as you know, recently they found that those who sheltered at home were 66% more likely to contract the coronavirus. And now, since both vitamin D and severe COVID-19 share similar health concerns, it just strongly suggests that lack of sunshine may be the underlying driver of the severity of this virus. So you're inside, you're not exercising, you're not eating right, you're not getting sunlight. There's a bunch of factors, but that's what studies suggest. Even more astounding, and which I didn't know about, is that it's cancer preventative, actually, internal cancer. So you're looking at about 15 or 16 cancers that sunlight prevents. And there's a ton of studies on this, observational studies. And especially against colon and breast cancer and prostate and ovarian cancers. Those are the big ones. So that's fascinating that we're not getting enough sunlight as a nation, and these cancers are increasing. So
now, put a point on that, you people in the past got a whole lot more sun than we do. You know, people spent a whole lot more time outdoors than we do today. We tend to be holed up in buildings a whole lot more, but I don't think skin cancer was a huge problem in the past.
Well, absolutely. We're a pasty nation. We're inside all day. It's just the way that our society is constructed right now. And, you know, we're not getting the sunshine. Now, with all this COVID-19 in my business, I've been outside quite a bit in the last few months, and I've got a nice tan that I haven't had for a long time. I'm training people outside, and I just cannot tell you the difference in how I feel. I feel alive and energetic, and so a lot of fresh air, a lot of sunshine, and yeah, it feels fantastic. But when you look at the health experts, they tell us the opposite, and they tend to lean on healthcare providers, of course, as a preventative measure. And there's just no way that's ever going to work out, because you're just looking at screening. That's not a preventative measure. And they will throw in some nutritional advice and lifestyle factors sort of on the side, right? But all of that advice runs counter to common sense. When you have the biggest and most beneficial factor there is, the sun, in addressing vitamin D deficiency.
Well, that is really fascinating. So why the dire warnings?
Well, we're told that by 2020, there's more people are going to be diagnosed with skin cancer in the U.S. than all other cancers combined. Now, keep in mind, they said diagnosed, and as well, that's only about 3.3 million cases. Okay, so at face value, when they say that, it can sound pretty ominous, but it's really a trickery through statistical manipulation. So the treatment for non-melanoma skin cancer has increased basically about 77% since 1994.
Now, what does that mean, non-melanoma? What does that refer to?
Well, the one that's non-cancerous.
Okay, I see.
So most of the rise in this increase in screening, so the more you look for it, the more you're going to find of something, right? So most of the rise that they're finding, the diagnosis, is very thin melanomas that are non-cancerous. So, and that's proven. They're not dangerous to health, and this is in their own studies. Now I went a little deeper with this, and this is fascinating. So of those diagnosed with skin cancer, of all of those that are supposed to be, you know, diagnosed or getting this, about 15,000 die of squamous cell carcinoma. That's the non-melanoma. But some people do die of them. But it's 15,000 in a nation of 330 million. So, and about 7,000 die of the deadly black mold form of skin cancer, that one that we all, that everyone fears, right? So you're looking, what, 22,000 people. 22,000 people. Now contrast this against 140,000 that die of cancer. I did a study of all these cancers, or actually only of the big four, and 140,000 die of that. So when you look at the protective element of vitamin D against these internal cancers that 140,000 people die of versus 22,000 that die of skin cancer, you know, that seesaw is going in one direction. And the journal Lancet, they said, you know, outdoor workers have a decreased risk of melanoma, decreased, while indoor workers have a higher risk. So that suggests to them that the sun has a protective effect against these cancers. And there's really two reasons for this. When the skin tans, it protects against the UV radiation. That's just a natural factor, right? So they can't produce the free radicals that leads to melanoma. And two, as the sun's rays hit the skin, the cholesterol in the skin is converted to vitamin D, and that's another protective factor. So my question is, could there be a better way to improve the mortality at a lower cost with fewer side effects than sunlight?
Well, that definitely is contrary to all of the conventional wisdom on this point, that you hear about the sun's damaging effects on the skin, and just how we need to stay in the shade. We need to lather up with sunscreen. And clearly there is a point where sunlight does become damaging. You can, I mean, anybody who's taken a nap out in the sun and come away with the lobster red sunburn knows that you can do too much. But what's the balance? What's the right amount to get without overdoing it?
Right. So as you said before, you know, sunlight is natural. We've been under the sun for thousands of years. Mankind has, you know, so we know it's we're basically born under the sun. But we are also disconnected. So again, we're inside and we tend to be very pale during the week. We're just not getting that. And then we get out and we burn on the weekends because we have fun and we forget to come out in the sun. So that's actually dangerous. The sunscreen itself is also dangerous because of the chemicals. So, I mean, when they do urine tests, they find that some of these chemicals are in urine, and these disrupt hormones and interfere with the endocrine system, and it's really bad. You know, people don't realize how fast these chemicals get into the system. And as well, the sunscreen, if you're lathering up, say you have an SPF of 15, well, you're really blocking 99% of vitamin D. That's not good. So you're trying to prevent burning instead of being using common sense and not staying out so long. And then the Skin Cancer Foundation says, well, that's all right, because you get an incidental 2 to 7% exposure, and that'll give you the vitamin D you need. 2 to 7%. If I give you odds of anything at 2 to 7%, you'll probably laugh. So apparently they're forgetting that 45 to 75% of people are vitamin D deficient right now. And that leads to a lot of disease. So even with the most conservative estimates, that makes this problem really widespread.
So what causes the skin cancer if it isn't sunlight?
Well, skin cancer is really, it depends on how you do it. So if you spend too much time in the sun, of course, you're abusing it. And that can cause it. So you don't want to get burned. Burning is one of the main reasons. So you should get slow exposure. Okay. So how do you safely get that exposure? You have to have a balance. And I just found that out with, you know, a couple months in a bright sunlight. I mean, I have to be out there sometimes when the sun is right overhead. So now you can get some of it through vitamin D, the vitamin D through foods, but that's insufficient as well. In the winter, it's hard to get the vitamin D that's protective for the sunlight, the slow exposure, right? So like if you live north of the 37 degree latitude line between Philadelphia and San Francisco, somewhere around there, you're not going to get a lot of sunshine there. So you're going to have to supplement in a winter there. And they say somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 international units a day to reach protective blood levels. The summer is the best time, slow exposure. They say, you know, everything I've looked at now is 20 minutes to half an hour is sufficient to get the vitamin D that you need. So if your shadow is shorter than your height, say at noontime, that's going to be that critical time that you get the most sunlight. But anywhere between 10 and 4, 10 a.m. and 4 p.m., you know, get that half hour to that you need. So let's say myself, I'm fair skinned, you know, a redhead would be far worse than me, but a half hour is great. So, and I was surprised how much you can get in a half hour. The journal Environmental Health Perspective said you can get 50,000 international units in a half hour. Hmm. I didn't think you could get that much in that short a time. And
so that's four or five times what you said there. They recommend that you get each day.
Right. We're illegal if we're out there. If you, so if you already have a tan or you're darker skinned, then it's, you know, it's going to take you less time, of course. And so if you're dark skinned, that same amount of time will give you about 8,000 to 10,000 international units, because melanin in the skin, you know, that's why people with dark complexions have a harder time with vitamin D absorption. Hmm. So you may need more time if you have a darker skin. That's all they're saying.
So just to return to the point that you made about the decreased exposure during the winter, you said you supplement, you need to supplement. You're talking about taking a vitamin in a pill form or something to get the vitamin D you need?
Yeah, I like the liquid. So I just keep a liquid around. Each drop is 1,000. And then you can just, and in the United States, actually here in Canada, it's 1,000. In the United States, you can get 5,000 and 10,000 per. It's just crazy how much you versus us here. So we just have to shake that bottle a little bit more. But yes, in the winter, vitamin D is crucial because, you know, everybody gets their cold in the winter. So your vitamin D stores are going down. So as you get to that January, February time, that critical time, the flu season just decimates people because tan is gone, vitamin D stores are down, immune system has dropped. Then the sun starts again, boom, everybody gets healthy again. You know, it has such a protective effect against that.
That is fascinating.
Viral contamination.
The deficiency of vitamin C is actually causing, or it's actually encouraging the spread of viruses and influenza.
Yeah, so a virus will take effect in the human body as the immune system drops. A strong immune system will fight a virus very efficiently. The way to get a strong immune system, one of the ways, you know, there's multiples, but vitamin D has a strong correlation to fighting such a influenza. So if your immune system is capable, is strong, you will fight that off. And one of the ways to do that is to make sure you have sufficient blood levels of the vitamin D.
Very, very interesting. Thank you very much for that. We've been talking to Jörg Mardian about the benefits of sunlight. He's working on an article about this. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Jörg, need to go out and get some sun.
It'll do you good.
It's time for today's last word.
I am teaching my son piano lessons. When we have a lesson, I give him instructions on how to spend his time practicing that week. And I can get really specific. Play this scale at 4/16th notes to the click at 104 clicks per minute. Make sure you don't let your left index finger collapse. If you make a mistake, I want you to put a check on your paper. Then play that scale perfectly two times before you move on. And if you can't finish that scale in 2 minutes, put an X on the paper, move on to the next scale. At your next practice, focus on the scales you had trouble with, decrease the tempo until you can play them perfectly, then increase one metronome click at a time until it's at tempo. You get the idea. When my son sits down to practice, he decides what he's going to do. He can scrupulously follow my instructions, or he can do some approximation of what I said and hope it's good enough. When he takes the second course, then his growth as a piano player is hindered, and my ability to help him is limited because he's not carrying out my instructions. I revealed to him my will. This is the means by which I want to help him become a better pianist. It's on him to do, to carry out what I said to the detail. There's a key ingredient he needs if he's going to follow through with what I told him. What is that ingredient? James 1 and verse 22 says, "Be you doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving your own selves." How can we be doers of the word? Well, in some very real ways, it comes down to this key ingredient. It may be the most important ingredient. Now, of course, to be a doer of the word, you have to know exactly what you're being asked to do. And there are times when it's difficult to discern what God wants. Maybe you have a hard decision to make and you have multiple equally good or equally bad options. But, you know, there are a lot of times and a lot of areas where we probably know exactly what God's will is. God communicates his will quite clearly in a lot of ways. It's on us to, number one, pay attention and listen intently, and then number two, to do it cheerfully, to discipline ourselves to follow through with what we know we're supposed to do. Herbert Armstrong defined righteous character this way. This creation of right spiritual character in us demanded free moral agency, that man must intelligently choose the right as opposed to the wrong, that he exercise free choice, develop self-discipline. What is this righteous spiritual character, he asked? It is that controlled ability in a separate independent entity to come to a right knowledge of the true from the false, the right from the wrong, and by free choice to choose the right and the true, and further to use the self-discipline to will and to actually do the right. How can we be doers of the word? In the end, so much of it comes down to self-discipline. Now, we have to understand that human effort doesn't create the character of God. We can't just will ourselves into righteousness. But how can God create his character in us if we don't do what he tells us? When you study the Bible or you read an article or hear a sermon or lecture or you do some self-examination and you learn something you need to be doing, what determines whether you will be a doer of the word at that point? It comes down to how much you discipline yourself to do it. You have to study your notes. You have to convert that message into action steps and get specific and give yourself reminders and put it into your schedule and tell your buddy about it so he'll hold you accountable. And above all, when you don't feel like doing it, you do it anyway because you know you should. Mr. Armstrong wrote, "I have defined character, that is true, righteous, holy character, as one coming to the knowledge of the true as opposed to the false values, the right instead of the wrong way, and two, making of one's own free will and volition the choice to do the right instead of the wrong." And then he says, three, the exercise of the will in actually doing the right instead of the wrong. Character, then, once the true knowledge is acquired and the right decision made, involves self-discipline. The truly educated person is a self-disciplined person. Again, this may be the most important key to being a doer of the word. Mr. Armstrong continued, "What then does this self-discipline involve? Two things. One, self-restraint, to resist the lower impulses and pulls in human nature, to restrain the self from desires, impulses, habits, or customs which are contrary to the right way. And two, self-propulsion, or determined initiative, to drive the self to do those things which ought to be done. Failing to do is a lack of self-discipline. Doing the easy thing instead of the right thing, it's a lack of self-discipline. Giving in to whims and distractions, that's a lack of self-discipline. In most cases, recognizing our failures as a deficit of self-discipline puts the blame right where it belongs. It's on us. God is doing all he can to help us, And it's He who builds holy, righteous character in us. He gets all the credit, but He can't do that if we don't have the self-discipline to do as He directs. God gets the credit for our successes. We get the blame for our failures. So carnally, we want to take the credit for our successes and pass blame off for our failures. But we're only going to have real growth in life when we get this right. We are to be doers of the word. God gives us His word. We have to be doers of it. He reveals His will. We must do it. Ask God to show you what to do and to give you the will to follow through, and then be tough on yourself. Discipline yourself. Be sure you're doing all you can to follow through and do as God instructs, so you truly can become a doer of the word. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Peter DeLau and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Christian Nestle Bovey. False friends are like our shadow, keeping close to us when we walk in the sunshine, but leaving us the instant we cross into the shade. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.